Hello, and welcome to the Innovation in Financial Inclusion podcast, focusing on emerging and innovative practice in financial inclusion. I am Paul Wick, and I'm from Community Finance Solutions at the University of Salford, a research unit specializing in financial inclusion and community finance. In this episode, we're going to be talking about financial education for children and young people. Research by the Money and Pensions Service shows that long-term money habits and behaviours are formed by the age of 7. Yet, financial education across the UK school system is quite uneven. To learn more about this topic, I've spoken with two leading experts in the field, Russell Wynard and Leon Ward. Russell is the Chief Operating Officer at Young Enterprise. Young Enterprise is a national charity which specializes in enterprise education and financial education and is a trusted and valued provider of knowledge, resources, and training to anyone teaching young people how to manage money. Leon is the Chief Executive Officer of MyBank, a charity delivering expert-led financial education programs for 5 to 25-year-olds with schools and youth organizations. So, Russell, perhaps you can start us off by telling us a little bit about, you know, what are the type of things that you would normally cover in financial education aimed at children and young people?
I mean, it's very broad, and it very much depends on the ability, the need. In some cases, the local area has an influence. From our perspective, we will work with anyone engaged in educating children and young people from age 3 all the way up to age 24. We have a set of financial education planning frameworks which aim to break down those learning objectives for different ages. So they're differentiated by age. They are not concrete. They are a guide, but they're there for educators, for parents, carers, youth workers, anyone that's involved in financial education to give an idea of the sorts of areas ranging from, you know, that coin recognition and the giving and receiving of change through to understanding various savings accounts, borrowing products, right up to the older age groups of beginning to understand more complex financial products such as mortgages, pensions, and beginning to understand your own personal attitudes towards things like risk, etc. So it's a very, very broad range. I would say that you do need to be guided by the young people which you have in front of you. It's them that will inform you as to what is most important to be covered, because we appreciate that there's a limited time, certainly in schools. So those choices are quite important as to what you do cover and what you expect a young person to be doing, maybe in the home or outside of school.
People might be quite surprised about the age at which you are supposed to start with financial education with children as young as 4 or 5. If you had a classroom filled with 5-year-olds, where would you start?
Well, a lot of that learning is possibly not done within an educational setting, although there are play groups, early years settings that will do a lot of role play around money. But some of that education is just through observation. You know, children first start their learning through observing. And money is something which until recently was fairly common to be observed by young people. I mean, the challenge that we have now within financial education sphere is that moving to more of a cashless society, it's not so common. And yet the transactions still happen. But what young people are seeing and that early cognition and learning process is not fully understanding what's happening there. So there is an additional step now in what young people need to support that learning. But I would say a lot of that very, very early years is done through role play. It's done through observation. My youngest daughter, who's 3 years old, will tell me that the currency we use in the UK is dollar bucks because she loves Bluey. So I'm trying my hardest at the minute to convert that to pounds and pence, but dollar bucks is winning, I'm afraid.
And Leon, how does that sort of chime? Is that sort of the, what are type of the things that that you would cover in my bank in terms of the in terms of financial education aimed at this particular group?
Yeah, so it's very similar. My bank works from the age of 7, so slightly older than Young Money does. But we plan our curriculum to the framework that Russell referenced. So what you'll see in the market is lots of providers around financial education, but all of us saying largely similar things in terms of the content. It's just the delivery methods that alter to a degree, although based on what Russell said, actually our delivery methods are pretty similar as well. So in primary schools, we use a range of techniques to teach. One is role play. I've seen children role playing being a banker, borrower and a saver, and at the end of that being able to define the difference between APR and AER in a primary school with year 5 students. So it's not just about the nice stuff about money, about having money. It's also about technical financial education. I think lots of people think primary school students are, and I think the thrust of your question indicates this, are unable to sort of level with some of the technicality behind it. But that's not our experience if it's delivered in a modular, bite-sized way. We use comics in our primary school classrooms as well to explain stories around money so young people can connect to those and take them home if they want to. But they will do a range of activities from writing, presenting, drawing, doing maths, problem solving, role playing. It's really designed, the curriculum's designed so that the trainer can think on their feet. We only send our staff in, so they're all MyBank trained trainers. And what will happen is they will kind of change their craft depending on lots of things, the size of the classroom, how the tables are panned out, whether or not there's lots of things to play with in the classroom. You sort of have a backstop, which is the MyBank way, but you can play with it and have some fun depending on your audience.
So there's no one size fits all for financial education. Does this lack of a standardized approach make it more difficult for schools to develop and deliver a financial education curriculum?
I think that's the same with any curriculum. You know, teachers read the curriculum, but they'll decide how to deliver it by and large, you know, because they respond to what's going on in their classroom. So if you've got a high ability, high achieving set, the way you will teach that is different to a high ability, low achieving set, or to a low ability with the potential to be high achieving. It depends. And I think as educators, that's where the magic is. The magic is in people being able to respond to what's going on in front of them, whether that is a child who is disconnected at the back of the classroom or the child that's super connected at the front of the classroom and trying to answer every single question and not letting other children get involved. So the curriculum is one side of it, but it's really the delivery methods that I think schools turn to people like us and Young Money to support them, because lots of teachers actually don't know about the content either. If you ask most of your adult friends, they won't be able to tell you the difference between APR and AER. But if you come to a year 5 primary school session with MyBank, the kids will. So.
And I think just to build on that flexibility point, I think that the really important thing around money and finance and financial education as a whole is that it doesn't necessarily have to be delivered as a subject in its own right. It can become embedded into many, many other areas of the school curriculum, thereby enriching that subject area, making it maybe more relevant, more engaging to young people, but saving teachers the time, because we know the curriculum is always compressed. So if they can't find that time within the curriculum to teach it as a subject in its own right, they can embed it within other subject areas, and that gets delivered equally as well through maths as it does through drama or music. The go-to is always maths, and just a mild word of warning, read maths. Maths is brilliant for money and finance. There's loads of context that you can use within maths for money and finance. But we mustn't forget that there's a whole other aspect of financial well-being, financial choices, that will never, ever be delivered through a maths lesson, because the maths is focused on the process. And you know, we make a lot of our decisions with our hearts rather than our heads. So understanding our own attitudes, our beliefs, our morals, our ethics are really quite important to how we manage our money. And that's not going to happen in a maths classroom. It'll probably happen within PSHE, citizenship, potentially drama, music, other areas. So maths, a great friend to money and finance, but not the only way of delivering, and it shouldn't be the only way of delivering.
I think that's important as well, because if you tell students it's a math subject, then you probably lose, you know, 50 to 75% of the classroom where people feel that that's a subject that's inaccessible to them. The other point around adaptation in the moment is that children come with loads of preconceived ideas, whether that's because they're learning through TV or through Roblox. We see a lot of young people referencing the Roblox economy and talking to them about money in that gamified way. Young people from a range of backgrounds, children, young people will come and their parents will talk to them about money in some households or not in others, often saying there isn't enough. We hear that quite a lot. We hear actually students are quite aware that there isn't always enough pounds to stretch. But I think this is about taking it to the next level and understanding their own personal relationship with money, which is something you need to level with in the classroom as well.
And that influence, you mentioned parents and carers as well, that influence we know that parents and carers have on a young person's financial capability is more powerful than an educator, than a teacher. That comes through in nearly every study, that the biggest influencer on a young person's financial capability are their parents or carers. So there's, Leon, you're absolutely right that there are households where money is discussed and it's a daily sort of learning experience, and then there are others where it's absolutely not, and that's sort of the challenge that we have with learning in a household, is that it may never be a topic of conversation. It may be that there are areas that parents and carers are uncertain about, and therefore that there could even be misinformation being communicated. So there is a balance to be had, and I think we should be supporting those conversations around money, those experiences around money in the family home. But equally, we need to ensure that there's a consistency of financial education within the classroom as well. Mm. And the two complement each other. And if you get those two working together, then you probably give a young person the best possible opportunity of being financially capable.
So what are the type of things that you, so if you're a parent or a carer, you know, if you could give them one or two pieces of advice, what would it be?
I think for me, we get asked this question quite a lot, and I think it's about just start with anything within the boundaries of your own comfort. So if you're taking your child shopping, right, you know, talk to them about the price of things, help them think about the budget. You could get them to add up the sums as they go around. This doesn't have to be talking about, you know, the impact of compound interest rates. We'd leave that to sort of us. You know, you can find the information out there, but those sort of basic lessons around money. When it's half term, one thing I would always encourage parents and carers to do when they're not in school is to think about, give the budget, if there is a budget, for play or for any activities you might do, whether that's lunch or whatever, to the child, and work with them to explain that, you know, going swimming might take up 50% of the budget, but if you go to the park and have an ice cream, you'd only use 20% of the budget. And so you could do that every day of the week if you wanted to. You could have an ice cream every day, but you might only be able to go swimming twice, or whatever it happens to be. You know, so contextual learning for that individual based on real life things. I think you see it quite a lot when parents and carers take their child to buy a gift for somebody else. They say, you know, you've got £5 or whatever it might be. I would say those sorts of lessons, just duplicate them at natural opportunities. And as the child gets older, you might want to embark on more serious conversations and maybe show them your payslip or show them your, you know, your pension statement, whatever it happens to be. So you're threading learning through their life, because financial education is a lifelong skill, depending on what you need when you need it. You know, you don't always need to be talking about compound interest rates, do you? You might do when you start to take out a mortgage, if you ever get there. But actually, for most people, there will be other stepping stones that they need to embed. So that would be my top tip, which is just to open the door and have a go.
And I suppose from my side, very similarly, there's good research from the OECD that says that young people that are given the opportunity to make choices, their own independent choices with money, are far more likely to become financially capable. So we know this isn't always possible because some people are not able to give pocket money or any money for their children to make decisions around. But if you can, and Leon's absolutely right, it doesn't matter how much that is. It could be 20 pence. If they are able to make the decision on what happens to that 20 pence, whether it's spent, saved, donated, whatever that young person chooses to do, that's helping them become financially capable. So enabling young people to make money choices, money decisions that are wholly independent. You know, you have to step back as a parent or carer and try not to influence. You've got to allow them to make those choices themselves. And it's a learning process, right? If they go and blow it all on one thing and then they haven't got money for anything else, they've learned something. And the only other thing from my side, and what we've seen quite a lot from conversations with teachers and parents alike, is that there are quite often money conversations that go on in a household that young people are excluded from. And it may not always be appropriate, but where possible, engage that young person in those conversations. So if there is the red notice bill that's come through for the energy, you have to change the level at which you're having that conversation. But if you can and you feel comfortable in doing so, just try and bring that young person into the conversation and explain, because we're seeing a rise in anxiety amongst young people in relation to money within the classrooms. This is in primary schools as well as secondary schools. And that no doubt is related to the cost of living crisis that we're experiencing and the level of negative money conversations that are going on in a household that young people are hearing, not understanding. And if we can just break that down a little bit and help them to understand, then we begin to reduce that anxiety. But it's an increasing problem within classrooms at the moment.
If parents, carers, and schools all do their bit to improve financial capability and deliver financial education, what can we realistically expect in terms of long-term outcomes for children and young people?
It's the key question, isn't it? So what is the impact of all of this stuff that is going on? I mean, for me, it all comes down to one thing, really, and that is young people being able to make more informed financial choices. And informed is the key word here. A lot of young people, as they move into adulthood, they're making financial choices, but they're not necessarily informed choices. They don't fully understand the consequences or the opportunities of the choice that they are making. Now, I could sit here and tell you that it would mean that there'll be no debt. We'll all manage our money wonderfully. That will not be the case. There will still be challenges with debt. But young people will have made a more informed financial choice as to taking out borrowing, as to managing that. I would really hope that it does reduce the level of problem debt, that there would be an impact in that respect. I also hope that there would be an impact on things like social mobility, as young people are making more opportunity, they're using wise money choices to take up opportunities that benefit them, investing in their future as opposed to blowing it on a one-off holiday. Those are the kind of areas for me that are really important, allowing young people to maximise the opportunities they have ahead of them, but also trying to prevent some of those negative consequences that we know can occur around money, but not being naive enough to expect that we'll eliminate them entirely, because that just won't happen.
I agree with all of that, and I think there's something to be said around young people. You know, it's really powerful just having knowledge when you start making decisions about your life. So things are done with you rather than to you. And money is one that we see where that doesn't happen enough, where people have things happening to them that they weren't fully aware of. So they sign contracts or enter deals or purchase financial services or products that aren't right for them. And you see this all the time. I mean, there are national scandals on it sometimes. You know, if you think back to the insurance products that people were reclaiming, that sort of PPI approach, you know, people didn't know what they were purchasing. They didn't know how to navigate the information put in front of them. A more recent example would be the rise in energy costs when the government introduced its subsidy and the cap. Most people assumed that your bill would not be more than £2,500 a year, which is fundamentally not what the government said. What it said was, for average users, that will be the cap, but the only way to cut your utility bills is to use less. So there is something around people just knowing what's going on to them, going on around them, what's happening to them. And then obviously, like Russell said, building those good money habits. And we run a program for first-time workers, so people that are about to get their first salary, you know, graduates, people that are school leavers entering employment. And more often than not, at the end of the first day of that course, all of them re-enroll into their pension because they understand what saving for a pension can do for you, plus the fact you get government top-ups, etc. So there is something about knowledge and information of what's happening to you and around you, but also building those good money habits where you can. But I would stress that financial education will only go so far. Like, it's not a magic money tree, as the government keep telling us. But, you know, even on an individual level, financial education doesn't necessarily increase the amount of money you've got to play around with. Yes, you might earn a little bit on investments, but the reality is, for most people, we're talking about small cash envelopes that we're trying to help them stretch as far as we can. And so it's not a sort of silver bullet. It's one part of the puzzle piece.
And the one other outcome we hope that financial education achieves for most young people is just a better understanding of where to go for advice, guidance, support, and where that is truly independent and where it's not necessarily independent. I think, again, that's another part of this making informed choices is understanding where you can go to seek further support, guidance, advice, how that supports your choices going forwards. I think that's really quite important.
What advice would you give to a principal of a primary or secondary school looking to improve their delivery of financial education?
So for me, I would always recommend looking at the financial education planning framework, which has these sort of bite-sized learning objectives, and maybe run a little bit of an audit. Because one of the first things, it's always interesting from a school perspective, and I have schools that say we don't do anything, and we run the audit and we find that actually there's a reasonable amount that's going on within the school. It's just no one had ever collated it in one place. So that's a real win from a school's perspective, because they didn't think they were doing anything and suddenly they are doing quite a bit. Then it's beginning to look at where is the need, where can we fit this in, and what opportunities are there to deliver this. It could be through subjects, within the curriculum, it could be extracurricular, it could be inviting, you know, the likes of my bank and others to come in and support your school in doing so. I would always advocate for teacher training. I think it's important that teachers understand how they can deliver financial education, what difference it means for the young people, but also what difference it makes for the school, because there are all sorts of pressures under school that schools are under, at the moment. And financial education can support with some of those other priority areas. And it's important that schools and senior leaders understand that, because that gives a greater currency to delivering financial education within your school. So that's the sort of process that I would go through. Complete a kind of mapping exercise and an audit, look at where the gaps are, build that provision in a way that is appropriate for your school, your learners, your community, and ensure that there is a level of teacher training involved in that, so that you've got staff members. It could be just one staff member, train the trainer approach, or it could be that you bring in a larger group of teachers to be trained. But then you've got something that remains in that school and can build and grow and become embedded within the curriculum.
We know that teachers love resources to help them support this sort of work that Russell's talking about. And I think those first few steps are the right ones. I would encourage anybody listening to this or exploring financial education to not worry about duplicating resources. There's loads out there. We've got loads. Young Money have got loads. The Money Charity have lots. Red Start Education have lots of resources that teachers can find. And I would think amongst the mix, there is probably something for everyone. Again, looping back to what we said earlier about that adaptability on the day, you know, if you have young people that in the classroom prefer a more structured approach to learning, then there are resources out there for you. But if you want to have more fun with it, there's also resources out there for you. So you don't have to do all the hard work. There are packets of support that we can give you, even if that isn't quite coming in to deliver if you don't want us to. The other thing I would say is, if you do want us to, feel free to steal what we do. You know, it's a shared craft, as it were. So I would add one final thought, which is, and Russell sort of hinted at it, about the community that the school is based in. I think schools, I know they're expected to do a lot already, but financial education to the parents and carers who are responsible for the children that go to your school is also another good use of time, so that parents, carers can come alongside you on this. It's not as sensitive, shall we say, something like sex education, where you absolutely do not want the parents in the room, you know, if you're 15 year old talking about your sex life, as it were. But if money, there is support there, you know, people can come and learn alongside you, and actually you might just capture parents and carers at a time that they're about to make potentially a poor financial decision. So I think that would be another tip for those schools that could perhaps get a bit further on a bit earlier.
I think that's a really interesting point. We've also observed this kind of vertical teaching, where young people, really, really quite young people, so we are talking the ages of 5, 6, 7, are engaged in financial education within their setting, their school. And they are taking that learning home, and they are beginning to educate parents, which is quite impressive, particularly when you've got primary age young people going home. And as Leon said, explaining the difference between APR and AER, you know, it is revolutionary. I used to teach in a school, and I taught science and financial studies. And financial studies parents evening was always really interesting, because the parents would come in and invariably they would tell me something that they had learned from their son or daughter from the class. Flexible rate more, or variable rate mortgage. Yet some parents had no idea that because they were on a variable rate mortgage, it meant that they were moving up and down according to the Bank of England base rate. We had people who had no idea that their pension contributions varied according to their income level and the taxation implications. It was fascinating.
That was a very stimulating discussion, I thought, but lots of insights about how you improve financial literacy of children and young people. I learned 4 things from Leon and Russell. Firstly, children and young people can acquire quite sophisticated financial skills and knowledge, including difference between APR and AER, pensions, where to turn for financial advice. And that may help them when they come to making decisions. They help them make informed decisions about their finances in the short term, but also longer term. Secondly, there is not one sort of right way to do financial education. It all depends on the context, on the skills and abilities of your learners, and lots of other factors. So there's not one single technique. You can use classroom teaching, or you can use games. And there's not one specific subject area in which you have to incorporate it. Thirdly, if you're a school looking to improve your financial education offering, you should start by mapping what you're already doing. And you might be surprised by the fact that you're actually doing more than you realized. And then you can start looking at where are the opportunities for incorporating additional financial capability content in the curriculum, but also in extracurricular activities. And there's lots of resources out there to do that, both on my bank's website, but also on Young Enterprise website, where you can find the financial education planning framework, which you may find useful. Finally, it's not just schools who have a role here, but carers and parents are also at least equally as important. The advice to them is not to be daunted, but to start with something basic, you know, everyday things that relate to money. So when you go shopping, show them or explain the price and how much you have to spend when you go shopping. Show them perhaps your salary or pension statement. And also enable them to make independent financial decisions, even if the amounts are, you know, very small, just a few pounds. And that's it for the Innovation in Financial Inclusion podcast with me, Paul. In the next episode, I'm going to be talking about financial education in the workplace with Jonathan Watts-Lay from Wealth at Work and Kaylee Frost from Health Assured. If you want to find out more or contribute to the discussion, go to hub.salford.ac.uk/CFS or follow us on Twitter at CFS_SBS. Bye for now.